We're going to talk about movies in this part of Focus 580. We're pleased to have back with us on the show again, David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. And every once in a while, we talk about movies and always have fun. If you're interested in his thoughts on a particular film, you can call in and ask. If there is a movie that you have seen lately that you thought was very good and you'd just like to call in and say, hey, I saw this terrific movie, that's fine. Maybe you'd even seen one you thought was bad and you'd like to tell people, stay away from this movie. It's no good. Any and all of that is fine. And other questions about film, too. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Any comments, questions, whatever, welcome. You'll come right here to the show, just like always. No one's going to grab you and expect you to pledge. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
For being here. I've been waiting for you to come by for a while because I just I wanted to ask a question about Ang Lee's movie, the big one, the big hidden
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon,
which I think, if I remember this right, is it true that this was the most successful foreign language film ever
in the U.S.
In the U.S. Yeah, in terms of box office.
In terms of a film left in its original language, it is the most successful foreign language film ever, because in fact the most successful foreign film ever was Pokemon.
No.
But dubbed into English doesn't count. Ang Lee also directed Pokemon. No, he.
Ang Lee's Pokemon.
Pokemon. So, yeah. No, it is the most successful foreign language film in the U.S. Box office history, having succeeded Life is Beautiful.
Oh, really? So I thought I had remembered reading that. And what do you? I wonder what you. How do you account for the success of something like this that's pretty unusual? I mean, if you've seen a lot of Chinese movies, you've seen movies kind of like this. One might say it was one of the best, but there are other movies like this. He didn't invent the conventions of this movie.
By no means. No, it's a very interesting question, and I actually have no idea why it's so popular. First of all, I mean, it's a good movie, but there's lots of good movies that aren't so popular. And there's a few movies that are better that aren't nearly as popular, and there's a few movies that are really bad that are very popular. So we have no way of accounting for that. But it's also a kind of a self-perpetuating. I mean, the kind of people who might be interested in a movie like this sort of, you know, it becomes a kind of event, even a mini event, almost as if, well, if you're interested in art movies, it's also a lot of fun, so this is the one to see. So there's a kind of momentum and groundswell, so that when a movie becomes fairly popular, it will actually become more popular. You know what I mean? It builds momentum. It wasn't really subject, because of the way it was distributed, it wasn't subject to the kind of first weekend, first 2 weeks, let's get it in, let's get it out sort of thing. So it actually was released more gradually. You know, it didn't play Central Illinois until February. It played the, you know, sort of the upper Midwest in January, New York, Los Angeles, Toronto in December. So it was allowed to build. All the reviews are good. Everybody who sees it pretty much liked it. I mean, I certainly recommend it, you know, would recommend it to anyone said I'm interested in, you know, a pretty good Chinese movie with a very good star power and a good director, et cetera. Mm. So, but, you know, I mean, in that respect, it wasn't subject to it either as a big hit or it immediately dies or, you know, or it's going to be too specialized. Now, remember, there's an English language screenwriter here, James Seamus, who had worked with Ang Lee before. So in a way, there is a consciousness of the international audience, particularly the American audience, which is such a big audience. So I really think that the film has a lot to offer. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, personally, and there's no offense to Ang Lee at all, but I wouldn't put Crouching Tiger even in the top 25 of martial arts movies that I've seen. But I'm not seeing a lot of them, as you know, and there's a lot of them that are really good. But I think, you know, made with an eye toward the international market, particularly the English-speaking market, it does offer the kind of things that American audiences want. And, of course, it's a very quality film. There's a very, you know, good, solid budget behind it. It has the kind of effects that Americans need to see. Some of the Hong Kong movies, you know, can look, especially in the early 90s or even late 80s, can look a little weird. And, you know, people sort of, you know, special effects have a status in this country that have to be a certain way. You know, Americans don't really like the kind of mid-60s Godzilla movies, except for cult fans, because they don't look so real. So Crouching Tiger has, you know, very good cinematography, real stars, and all that. So in a way, it has all the elements. But frankly, I'm really shocked that it did so well, but I'm also glad.
Yeah. I had a reaction to it, and I wanted to try it on you again as somebody who's seen a lot of Chinese movies. I guess, as much as I liked the film and I thought it was very good, I came away with this feeling that while this movie was in Chinese, this was not a Chinese movie. There's something about the sensibilities of this movie that I think really seemed very Western to me.
Well, no, that's where I think they were deliberately going for some of that. But, you know, it does rely on certain conventions that are only, well, not only, but almost unknown in this country. And that, of course, is the conventions of the women warrior. Mm-hmm. So that in that respect, it does a very good job of highlighting that. But I do think that it has a definitely a Western sensibility and a Western accessibility, particularly in the plot with the young girl. I mean, she's a kind of American teenager. And that's maybe what I think, you know, helps account for it. Although many people, such as myself, actually would like to have seen the story of Chow Yun-fat and Michelle Yeoh, a kind of older audience, a more mature thing. And I actually heard they were going to make a sequel, which may be a prequel.
Indeed.
Because, you know, they can't really make a sequel.
Oh, I guess not.
Yeah, but we won't say why, but they can certainly make a prequel.
Well, it certainly seemed to be one of the things that seemed to me the case is that this movie had more dialogue than an awful lot of other, at least if you look at the costume dramas, those kinds of movies, it seems like it had much more dialogue than most of the other movies like that I have seen. There's an awful lot of talking in this movie.
No, there is an awful lot of talking, but in some of the Cantonese dialect movies, they like to have a lot of talking because the Cantonese language is so expressive and humorous. But again, with the consciousness of a kind of transnational audience that Hong Kong has, they will actually keep their dialogue more minimal because they'll appeal to non-Cantonese speaking audiences. And you don't want to have too many subtitles, especially when they recognize their movies will mostly be seen on video and on television. Mm-hmm. Whereas this movie, you know, is a kind of action movie and a kind of art movie and a kind of dialogue-driven movie. So you're absolutely right. I mean, it does have the kind of highfalutin appeal and also stages its action scenes very nicely.
Yeah. It was interesting to me that here, when it showed in Champaign-Urbana, it was playing simultaneously at two commercial movie houses and the Art.
Yeah.
At the same time, three different places.
That's right. And all three theaters have quite different demographics, so it was a movie that appealed to everybody.
Right. Our guest this morning is Dave Dasser. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. We're talking about movies. And if you have questions, comments, things you'd like to say, you can call us, 333-9455. Here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers. We'll start with Peoria and line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think Gone with the Wind is one of the better movies that I ever saw. And another one was Al Jolson and Sonny Boy. That was the first talkie, I believe.
Well, the first talkie with Jolson is generally thought to be the jazz singer.
Sir?
The jazz singer?
Yes.
Yes, that's generally given credit as the first talkie, not Sonny Boy.
But I wonder if maybe you're
short?
Actually thinking of the same movie. And, well, in any case, I think probably there would be a lot of people who would put Gone with the Wind on their list of solid American movies.
Oh, yeah. No, it's generally credited as a dollar spent, a dollar earned, the most successful movie ever made. It was a big budget, high quality event picture at the time. I mean, it's never lost any of its luster. It's interesting, you know, speaking of Gone with the Wind, about the current situation where someone wrote a sequel to the novel, and they're apparently legally going to suppress it, which I think is a shame. But that's just a kind of aside.
I don't know if it was the estate of Margaret Mitchell. Somebody took
them
to court
and said, plagiarism.
This is copyright infringement.
Yeah.
It's too
bad.
And I guess I don't really understand how one draws this line between satire and fairly taking something else and when you know that you've gone too far and it's actually you're infringing on somebody's copyright.
Oh, well, copyright law is very tricky. But, I mean, I have no legal understanding of this issue. I just think it's too bad because I think there's a lot to engage. And from my point of view, I can't imagine that the novel is called The Wind Done Gone. And I can't imagine that it would hurt the commercial success of Gone with the Wind, which has already made, you know, $18 billion. But that's just an aside. No, but the thing about Gone with the Wind that's interesting is that it really was an event movie at the time. And what's interesting is Hollywood, you know, in that era kind of made even its big budget movies sort of routinely. And if you look at 1939, there was an incredible number of really good movies that came out. But most of them were sort of, you know, let's make a movie. You know, John Ford made three movies that same year, and they're all great. But it's the year of Stagecoach, you know, and Young Mr. Lincoln. But, you know, they're kind of almost routine. But Gone with the Wind was, you know, the search for who will play Scarlett O'Hara. And, you know, Clark Gable must play Rhett Butler. And, you know, and it was just an event. And it really has held up. It's interesting also because, you know, Hollywood tries that sort of thing every few years, and most of those event movies don't hold up. Rain Tree County is my favorite example of they were looking, you know, Elizabeth Taylor, Montgomery Clift, let's do the Gone with the Wind of the Midwest or wherever Rain Tree County. And the movie wasn't much of a hit, and now I bet there isn't 15, 20 people who've seen it.
Yeah, I actually have seen it. I'm sure I've seen it on television.
Yeah, well, mostly on television, yeah. But, you know, I've seen it too. I just don't remember it being very good, which is another.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the kind of thing I mean, is Gone with the Wind has really, really held up for various reasons. But, you know, the bottom line is it's a really good-looking film. I'm not a major fan of it for a number of reasons, but it is an impressive piece of filmmaking.
Yeah. Let's talk with somebody else here in Atlanta, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Back to Chinese movies. Crouching Tiger obviously had some direction toward a wide appeal, and I've always been a little skeptical of Chinese movies in general, that they might not necessarily appeal to me, not that they wouldn't be good, but I had the pleasure of seeing King of Mask not too long ago, and I came out of that deciding that Chinese can make real movies.
Well, yes. Interesting you bring up King of Mask, because it will be the free family matinee. It did play theatrically here, and it is a fine film. You know, what was interesting about King of Mask to me was that it seemed rather reminiscent of the Chinese films that we'd been seeing here. So that in that respect, it was another good Chinese movie, if you know what I mean. It's like, oh, no, another good Chinese movie, ho-hum. So it's not that I'm being ho-hum about it, but that it was part of a cycle of movies starting in the mid-'80s. So for about 15 years, where maybe two or three a year, the Chinese PRC, you know, mainland Chinese movies would come out. You know, they're kind of period movies. They look at interesting political and gender issues. They have the mainland Chinese movies, I think, have one of the greatest visual sense. You know, the directors have some of the greatest visual sensibilities in the world today. I mean, Ang Lee is Taiwanese, and I think even PRC directors have even a stronger visual sense than he does. But Ang Lee has a great visual sensibility. So they're really kind of nice movies with universal appeal. So I'm glad that you thought King of Masks was in that mode. But there's, you know, I would say maybe six or seven movies that are as good or even better than King of Masks, which is saying a lot.
Well, I'll have to keep my eyes open then, because it sure woke me up to the creativity, mainly like you say, the visual effects of that movie. So nice talking to you.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks.
You know, there's also a nice, I think one of the things that makes them sort of universal in their appeal is they have a kind of sense of social injustice, but they're kind of obviously about that, but they're not preachy. The King of Mask is about gender issues and what can a girl do and what can a boy do. And you go back to, you know, one of the main breakthrough PRC movies, the Farewell, My Concubine, and all that. And so, they're working in a similar mode, but it's always a very... It's always a very powerful mode. And King of Mass is a good film because it's kind of low-key. I mean, Farewell, My Concubine is an epic, and King of Masks is much, much lower-key. And so it works in that respect. Yeah.
Well, it seems like there's really, when you talk about Chinese movies, there are Chinese art films like Farewell, My Concubine and Raise the Red Lantern, and all of those movies starring the incredibly beautiful Gong Li. And then there are a different tradition, the movies that they made in Hong Kong, for example, that were that were more like really, really pure. Some, I mean, a lot of them really well-made movies, and with guys like Chow Yun-fat and Jet Li, who are have real screen presence, but movies that are, you wouldn't say that they were art films. They're really pure entertainment films.
Well, I would say that the thing about Chinese movies is, you know, scholars would sort of be pedantic and say the three Chinas, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the mainland. Mm. And they all have different traditions. Now, obviously, there's going to be connections, especially, you know, Hong Kong and Taiwan have had a lot of commercial commercial competition as well as commercial cooperation. You know, where the great here's what's funny: one of the great directors that Ang Lee borrows from is a director named King Hu, who passed away a few years ago. Now, King Hu was born in the mainland, got his start in Hong Kong, and is essentially a Taiwanese director. So the distinctions between the three Chinas are not hard and fast. But King Hu did a film called Touch of Zen that I find very much to be the source for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, both visually and kind of thematically. But unfortunately, Touch of Zen isn't generally available. And King Hu hasn't really benefited from all the DVD releases so far. Mm. I don't quite know why. Maybe because they're torn between being Taiwanese and being older Hong Kong ownership. But the different traditions of Taiwan, Hong Kong, and the mainland really do show up, where the Hong Kong cinema has been a almost strictly commercial cinema, with the occasional art film movement or art film attempts by, you know, but they're much lower budget even than the commercial films, which are fairly low budget. But the PRC, with its strong studios in Beijing and some of the other studios, actually can be fairly high budget comparatively. And make films with an eye toward the international market and the art market, whereas Taiwan actually has the biggest problems because they're not sure if they want to be commercial and they're not sure if they want to be artsy. They don't have the distribution, obviously, of the mainland, which is close to them, but they also don't make movies as commercially successful as Hong Kong. So they have some really, really first-rate directors, but no real great commercial industry, which is why Ang Lee has had most of his movies, even his first Taiwanese movie, The Wedding Banquet, is partly funded by Western sources.
Yeah. And for people who, Crouching Tiger, I can never keep that straight. If that was the first Ang Lee movie that you've seen, I would definitely say go back and see some of his other movies, particularly The Wedding Banquet. Also, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman.
Woman is one of the greatest, one of the greatest films that I've ever seen. But he also, you know, he's also done the Sense and Sensibility, part of the, you know, the Jane Austen collection. And I still think The Ice Storm is his most underrated film.
Didn't he also direct a Western?
He directed the Civil War drama. That was the film debut of Jewel, although I haven't seen that, and I keep meaning to see that, and notice how I'm blanking on the title. But someone will remind us of his...
It's a film that I know.
It's a post-Civil War Western.
And it must have sort of come and gone without getting very much notice.
It's interesting because Jewel at the time was so hot that so big that you would have thought that people might have seen the movie, if nothing else, to see Jewel.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, we're talking here with Dave Desser, and we also want to encourage you to call in and make a pledge. And we have a real good reason for you to do this now, to call this morning, because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we have a drawing. We have some passes for Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival that's going on here this week, starting on Wednesday. And we also want to take the opportunity to talk with Kim Cronick, who is in our Pledge Center. And I think, Kim, the message that I got is that we have at least one person who has called to get in on the drawing?
Yes, that's right. So we need you to, we still have another, well, its drawing is open. All you've got to do is call between now and noon, 244-9455. And we'll enter you in that drawing to win one of two pairs of passes to the third annual Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. It is a fabulous, fabulous festival. I saw it last year, and you get this drawing prize lets you get into all 14 screenings, so it's really, really wonderful. You'll get the full schedule. It's held in the historic Virginia Theater where Roger Ebert used to see movies himself. It's just a wonderful, wonderful thank you gift. Well, it's not a thank you gift. Actually, you just have to call in. You don't even have to pledge, but right now we're in the pledge drive, so we'd really appreciate your financial support. Call 244-9455. The phones are ringing. Lois is taking a call right now. Kathy's standing by to take your call. So we're off to a good start. It's just another way that WILL can say, Thank you to you. And it's just one and a couple times a year where we ask for your financial support to keep these programs on the air. Earlier, you heard Dr. Susan Troopin. She's a regular on the program. We also have personal finance, children's health, home care and maintenance, lawn and garden care, cooking. We offer a great variety on Focus 580. And David's been doing it for a long time. He enjoys doing it. And, you know, I think, David, the best part of your show for me is that people get to call in and they don't get cut off. They don't get talked down to. They get a chance. You get a chance to ask your questions, to participate in a conversation that WILL facilitates. It's wonderful radio. It's radio worth supporting. Give us a call, 244-9455.
The listener support is so important, and over time, we've talked about this again and again, it is true that we do, this station receives some federal money, but it is also true, in the past couple of years, federal funding for this station has dropped. It's dropped by more than $150,000, and part of the reason for that is that across this country, public radio has really grown, and that's great. I mean, we have to be happy for the people in other parts of the country, because there was a time when I started in public radio, there was a time when there were places in this country where you couldn't get public radio. Well, it's really not true anymore. There are a lot more stations, but that also means that the large number of stations is drawing on this fund, this source of funding that really hasn't grown very much. So for that reason, it is ever more important, because it's a big chunk of our budget, listener contributions. It's ever more important that people who listen also are supporters.
And David, you make a good point, too. We're local public radio. We're your local public radio station. That's why we bring in people from the local community to be on the show, to take your questions about topics that are important to you. It's what makes us, it's our local presence, I think, that stands out compared to all the other media choices you have there. And that's really worth supporting. So call right now, 244-9455. Remember, if you call between now and noon, we'll enter your name in the drawing to win those passes to the Overlooked Film Festival with Roger Ebert. It's a great, great thing. Want to mention one more thing. If you can become a member at the $75 level, the member benefit card is wonderful. You get to go to restaurants in the area, get two entrees for the price of one. I tell you, David, I was in Bloomington, and I used the member card at Gateway to India, Juju Sports Bar, Fiesta Ranchera. Oh, just great food, and what a great thing to get two for one.
Sure.
We've got things, restaurants in Champaign, Bob Evans, Basmati, another Indian restaurant, Carmen's, and Sonia's. There's just a whole variety to choose from. And it's part of the member benefit card for a pledge of $75. But whatever you can afford, maybe it's $40, the basic membership. Maybe you're a senior, it's just $25. $75, though, gets you the member benefit card. But whatever you can afford, go to the phone now and call 244-9455. The phones are ringing. We're doing well. You be our next caller, 244-9455.
And if you want to be entered into that drawing, only about another half an hour now. So that's just during this hour of Focus 580. As Kim mentioned, we have two pair of passes to Roger Ebert's Overlook Film Festival, and they're good for admission to all 14 screenings. So if you wanted to, you could see every movie that there was in the festival. But to get in on that, you need to call. You don't have to pledge. We'd like it if you did, but it's not required. So give us a call. We'll enter your name in the drawing, 244-9455. And thank you, Kim. We'll talk to you again in a little while.
Okay.
Our guest this morning here on Focus 580 is David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. Every once in a while, he's here on the show. We talk about movies. And you can call in, and if you have questions or maybe there's something that you've seen recently you'd like to talk about, you'd like to recommend, great, you can do that. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I guess when we talk at this time of the year, before we're getting ready to go into the big summer blockbuster season, is there anything that you know that will be coming up here over the next couple of months that you at least are looking forward to, you think might be something to take note of?
Yes, but before we get into that...
Oh, yes?
The Jewel... Ang Lee movie is apparently, according to my dim memory, called Ride with the Devil.
Yeah, you are correct.
So anyway, Ang Lee is a wonderful director and a unique figure in our... and graduate of the theater department of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. But I think he's a great director anyway. It's an interesting summer coming up because it is going to be chock full of really big budget movies. some of the disturbing trends of the summer blockbuster season are apparent with a number of sequels and remakes, but they can be good. And we also see that the synergy between films and home video continues, and video games continues, as some people are eagerly awaiting the feature film version of Tomb Raider.
with
Angelina
with
Jolie.
Actors.
With yeah, live actors. Angelina yes. Jolie. So I think that I'm most looking forward to The Mummy Returns, which is actually just in a couple of weeks, which looks like they spent at least twice as much money as they did on the previous one. And I also think you can see some of the sort of Hong Kong influence showing up again in how some of the action scenes are staged and a lot of people are looking forward to the Steven Spielberg production of the long-delayed Kubrick film AI, Artificial Intelligence. Hmm. And if that movie is good, that may very well threaten to be the big hit of the year. I'm also a fan of Tim Burton, who is also working with a budget even bigger than he had with the first Batman. And he has... It's not really a remake, but a rethinking of Planet of the Apes, which comes out at the end of July. And from what I've seen, it's going to be visually stunning, but how it works from the sort of classic Planet of the Apes, I don't know. But Tim Burton, I think, is an enormously talented guy, and if he makes a film, it's probably worth seeing. I still think Edward Scissorhands is one of the oddest little... wonderful films ever made. There's just something so appealing about Edward Scissorhands.
Well, you know his movies are going to have visual appeal.
Yes. They're
going to be amazing things to look at the very least. I'm still not quite sure about that. Anytime you remake something, I sort of wonder, you know, why? It was like when the guy who decided to remake Psycho. Are you doing this?
Yeah. Once major filmmaker who shot himself in the foot, Gus Van Sant. Yeah, no, that was Psycho was literally a remake. It was let's do it again, which I wasn't quite sure. So I think Planet of the Apes is a kind of revisioning of the film. But our AI threatens to be a big film. But, you know, another potential film, certainly one that I'm interested in, is Moulin Rouge, which is the first film by Baz Luhrmann since William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, the big hit with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes. Mm-hmm. I'm not that big a fan, as it were, of Toulouse-Lautrec, but I think, again, if someone with a lot of talent makes a film, we should probably think that it has great potential.
And how does this relate to the one with Jose Ferrer, the one maybe people...
People will know that. That's a John Huston film. I suspect it's the same topic, but I don't imagine it's a remake. Although the John Huston film is very memorable. It's one of the most creative uses of color in all of 1950s cinema. But I suspect it's the same character.
Same guy.
Without
the
in
painter.
Any way... With, yeah, the painter,
Toulouse
obviously.
Lautrec.
Right.
Yeah.
And his great activist period of the 1890s. I was going to say the 90s, but we have to go back. So that has some potential. I'm surprised there's a Dr. Doolittle 2, but indeed there is a Dr. Doolittle 2. Dr. Doolittle was really a very disappointingly mediocre film.
The one with Eddie
with
Murphy.
With Eddie Murphy, yeah. Well, the original Dr.
Not
Doolittle
to,
was,
the one with,
was a disappointingly way more mediocre film with Rex Harrison. But there was really nothing to Dr. Doolittle, so I'm not sure what, you know. I mean, again, he can still talk to the animals. So that one is low on my list. And, of course, the big Memorial Day film this year is Pearl Harbor, which I'm ambivalent about, but we'll probably see. I mean, I think of it as part of this whole, use of World War II for various reasons, but... I'm somewhat ambivalent about that. So that's really some of the big blockbusters. Certainly, there's a lot. I mean, there's be about 100 films at least coming out.
Yeah. Well, we have a caller here. Let's talk with them on our line number one in Champaign.
Oh, hi.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of films in Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival that are totally unfamiliar to me, and I was wondering if you could tell me, like, Dragonflies. And On the Ropes, and Songs from the Second Floor. Do you know anything about those films, or what do you think of them?
Yes, I haven't seen them. On the Ropes is a documentary about boxers. one of whom has subsequently, or actually during the making, was sent to prison for drugs. I haven't seen it. Songs from the Second Floor actually has made the film festival circuit over the, what do you call it, over the past half year or so, and it's doing very, very well at this festival circuit. And again, since it hasn't actually played commercially, this is a rare opportunity to see it. Now, I haven't seen it. Again, I actually was at a festival where it played, but I didn't see it because it was playing at a competing time. And again, one of the things that's nice about a festival like this is the opportunity to see films that would probably never open commercially. Dragonflies, The Baby Cries is a short, which I actually haven't seen. They're showing it in front of the screening of Nosferatu, which is a nice idea. There was a time where short films preceded all feature films. But again, I haven't seen it. So you bring up some of the more obscure films. Though I do know, as I say, Songs from the Second Floor has been very successful in the international festival circuit, but probably wouldn't play in an area like this except on video. So it's an opportunity to see it on a big screen.
There are a couple of others, Marianne and Such a Long Journey.
Yes, two more that we haven't seen, then again, that probably wouldn't play. Now, these are interesting films, which I'm interested in both of them seeing. One, because Marianne, because of its there's a trend that only maybe sort of specialists know about, which is a kind of ethnic American filmmaking. This happens to be an Iranian-American film, but I've been interested in Asian-American films. And it's all about how people of clearly sort of ethnic or racial backgrounds, how they get along in mainstream America. And so Mariam definitely fits in that sort of idea. And the other film you mentioned is based on an Indian expatriate novelist with an Icelandic director, but made in India. So, again, these are the kind of films that most likely would never get a theatrical distribution here, and the kind of films that you might only see at festivals, and which is nice to have an overlooked film festival, because, again, I haven't seen these films. I haven't. Rogers said he saw one of them at the Hawaii Film Festival, another one he saw at the Cannes Film Festival. Those are two festivals that I haven't had a chance to go to. But it's great to have them here at the overlooked festival. And remember also that they'll be bringing screenwriters, producers, directors of those particular films, the directors of all those films that we have mentioned, I believe, will be here. And one or two of them will also have the producer here.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Oh, good. All right. Thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And the Nosferatu that they're showing, this is the F.W. Murnau?
Yeah, this is the Murnau. And the Art Theater will bring back Shadow of the Vampire, which played, commercially, though to minor success. But Shadow of the Vampire, with John Malkovich and Willem Dafoe, is about the making of Nosferatu. And Nosferatu is one of the most liked and respected of the German films of the 20s. Mm. And, of course, it's being presented with live musical accompaniment, a reminder that there was never such a thing as silent films. There was only films that didn't have soundtracks on them, but nobody ever showed a film in a theater silent. Whether as people, the piano or the organ or the live orchestral accompaniment was a routine part of all films. And in the last 20 years, this kind of thing has become even more popular with perhaps even more sort of creative music. When they did something at the Krannert a few months ago, the Dracula presentation with the Philip Glass, which was kind of weird because Dracula was a so-called sound movie. But even so, the music is kind of avant-garde like. And but Nosferatu, if you've never seen it, is really superior. My only problem with it is I've actually seen a good print with live orchestral accompaniment not too long ago, so I've actually seen it fairly recently. But it is a fine film, and Shadow of the Vampire is an interesting film. But if you know Nosferatu, Shadow of the Vampire is perhaps becomes a little better. If you don't know Nosferatu, then it's like, who's this character and what the heck is going on?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure Malkovich and Dafoe should ever be in a movie together. They're both so weird. got to have like somebody normal, but nevertheless, it was an enjoyable movie. I wouldn't say it was good, but it was definitely enjoyable.
And certainly, I think if you're interested in the horror genre, or also if you're interested in silent films, you really should see Nosferatu. It is one of the creepiest. If you'd think at the time, oh, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't make anything that would be really, because of their technical abilities, make anything that would be really gripping. Well,
I mean, arguably, there's a lot of good filmmakers at the time, but arguably, Murnau in the 20s was as good a film director as anybody. And the German cinema of the 20s was just, one of the three great cinemas in the world, along with the Soviet cinema and the U.S. cinema. So, I mean, if you've never seen Nosferatu, and also, you know, we sometimes still think of silent movies as these kind of herky-jerky motion, and that's just technical problems that should not be there. And presented properly, correctly, in 35 millimeter with a live orchestra, it's even if you've seen it on video, you haven't seen Nosferatu.
Yeah.
Or in one of our old scratchy prints that we show up for our poor film history classes.
We have about 10 minutes left. Well, maybe a little bit less if you're interested in calling in, talking with our guest, David Desser. Tell us about a movie that you've seen, or maybe you have questions, you can call. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I, at the risk of, again, going on about, and we got somebody else calling here, about Chinese movies, I do think... who knows? We may be seeing some movies that were inspired by this movie by Ang Lee. But I have begun to wonder, in fact, whether the Hong Kong action film, particularly that's set in the present day, movies, for example, like movies made by John Woo, whether it's becoming something of an international style, whether some of the conventions, I think we have seen them over the past, I don't know how many years, creep into a lot of other movies, certainly movies made by American directors. Now, John Woo, he's making movies here, and some other Chinese directors have made movies here. But I'm wondering if that has now transcended Hong Kong.
Oh, absolutely. There's no American action movie that doesn't have the influence in some way or another from Hong Kong. There's no question about it. And if you look at some of the same directors who've been making action films for years, you see that their styles have shifted to account for Hong Kong movies. It is and not only American action movies, but the Hong Kong action film has become the international style, because you also see it in other popular cinemas, including the Indian cinema, which does some of the things, and that's been an enormously popular cinema with its own tremendous audience. But even there, they've shown the influence of directors like John Woo and Ringo Lam. Mm-hmm. And these kinds of influences, of course, are circular. I mean, Hong Kong movies have long been influenced by Hollywood films. When they give them American or, you know, English language titles, they always take some title that's already familiar. The Hong Kong title will be something, it's not a translation of a Hong Kong title. So that the great Choi Hark films with Jet Li that we know as Once Upon a Time in China are variations of the great Leone films Once Upon a Time in the West and Once Upon a Time in America. But the Once Upon a Time in China films are called Wong Fei-hung from the
lead character.
The lead character and, the kind of cult figure that is Wong Fei-hung. But even there you see a lot of, transnational, cross-cultural circularity of influences. You know, I would say Akira Kurosawa has been an influence on them, and Sam Peckinpah has been an influence on them. But then John Ford is an influence on Kurosawa, et cetera. So these things, Jean-Pierre Melville is one of the most important influences on John Woo. So it's like, who's to say what's, there. But the Hong Kong style of staging action movies is just everywhere. Even a martial artist like Steven Seagal with his latest film, whatever it was called,
Exit Wounds.
Yeah. All of a sudden, Seagal has had his own sort of style for years, and then the climactic battle of Exit Wound between Seagal and Michael Jai White is all of a sudden Hong Kong staged with flips and trips and slow motion and stop motion. I said, wait, you know, so you know, even Seagal, who's obviously influenced by Hong Kong martial arts of the 70s, when he, you know, makes his own style and his own martial arts, then he gets influenced by. So there really is a lot of, there's no way that Hong Kong movies aren't, you know, as influential as anybody's movies in the world today.
Yeah. We have a couple minutes left. We have a caller here, Southeastern Illinois. Let's talk with them. Line four. Hello.
Yeah, you guys are weird.
Well, nobody's perfect.
Just a couple of observations that have nothing to do with anything that you've been talking about. One is I mean, she's not a great actress or anything, but I think the accomplishment that Melanie Griffith has to the way she looks and the way she sounds not find herself restricted to comedy bimbo roles. I mean, she really is has quite a range of things. I don't know whether either of you have seen Nobody's Fool, the Paul Newman movie.
Oh yes, yes, yeah, very good
yes.
movie.
Yeah,
and
no.
that is an excellent. I mean, it struck me like a stage play. The level of acting from the little boy to Jessica Tandy. I mean.
No, that's an incredible cast. I agree. I agree with you about Melanie Griffith, and I think she's wildly underrated. She works a lot, so which means that people in Hollywood appreciate her. But I think she's wildly underrated.
Well, she.
I think Working Girl is a fantastic film.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
for instance.
One other thing, observation, and that is, I made this comment with somebody else the other day: the disappearance of the beautiful woman from American movies.
Well, nobody. I guess I hadn't noticed. You think there aren't any beautiful women in American movies anymore?
I think there are pretty women, but what I'm talking about is a beautiful woman. The difference between a pretty woman and a beautiful woman in the movies is the way she is presented. I mean, it's the way the cinematographers look at her. It's the way the lighting men look at her.
I agree with you. It's part of the whole different style, and I actually think it has to do with the ubiquity of other discourses besides film, and that is to say, I mean, these stars show up on television, these stars show up in the tabloids, these stars show up on game shows, and the style of cinematography and the sort of beautiful woman that you refer to, I think, has to do with the fact that stars used to be in a kind of different world or a different realm, and it's very difficult to sustain that mystique when stars are all over the place. And that's maybe, and also the kind of movies. You know, you get more realistic movies, you get more gritty movies. People don't accept sort of romance and musicals and that sort of. You know, the melodrama is not the same as it was. So if you have a different kind of film, a different kind of genre, stars are more ordinary today. I think maybe that's perhaps why you don't get it.
Probably is one explanation. But now you take some movies that had the beautiful woman in them. Hitchcock movies, for example. I mean, he presented not pretty girls, but beautiful women. And yet his movies go today. I mean, people watch, you know, they've held up.
No, they have. It's just, I think it's hard to find an Ingrid Bergman or a Grace Kelly these days.
But look, he even did it with Joan Fontaine. I mean, Joan Fontaine was not that pretty, but I mean... and one more other thing, too, is, well, I guess that was the 2 points I wanted to make. So I guess
okay.
If you have anything more to say, well, I'll listen after I hang up.
We're just about at the point we're going to have to finish. I don't know. Maybe real quick, one thing I will do is I think often when you're here on the show, I say video picks, things that if there's something that you missed it when it was a theater, you can rent it now. Anything you might suggest?
I have two. One of them is a sort of everyone was trying to make this movie more successful and they never really managed, and that's Wonder Boys. Wonder Boys is really very good. I don't know quite why no one ever appreciated it. And the other is because Renee Zellweger is out now with...
Bridget Jones,
yeah. I think the very quirky Nurse Betty.
All right.
Yes.
Good. Wonder Boys, Nurse Betty. So
those are
my
video picks of the week.
Check those out. And thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It's always fun to have you here. David Desser, he's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. Every once in a while, he's here. We talk about movies.